Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. I'm Dr. J. For the next half hour, keep your mind open and your radio tuned to the left as we present a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Today on Change Surfer Radio, we'll be listening to a panel discussion on biological hard science fiction. The panelists were the science fiction authors Octavia Butler, Hal Clement, Catherine Kramer, Paul DeFilippo, Gwyneth Jones, and Robert Sawyer. They were speaking on July 14, 2002, at the 14th Annual ReaderCon, a conference on literary science fiction held every summer outside of Boston. For more information about the conference, go to ReaderCon.org.
I'm Octavia Butler, and I think probably my best-known hard biological SF would be the Xenogenesis series, Dawn, Adulthood, Rights, and Imago.
Okay. I'm Hal Clement. I've been writing for close to 35 years, I guess, stories which might be called hard biological science fiction. They were inspired originally by the first work on the DNA code, and I figured when we got that thing reduced to engineering practice, we could do all sort of things with what I've been calling pseudo-life over the years. And I haven't stopped.
I'm Robert J. Sawyer, and I am biological. My latest novel is Hominids, which is certainly a piece of biological SF.
I'm Catherine Kramer. I just co-edited with David Hartwell an anthology called The Hard SF Renaissance, focusing on hard science fiction of the 1990s, which is coming out this fall from Tor. And I also just wrote the chapter on hard science fiction for a forthcoming academic book, which Gwyneth is also in, called The Cambridge Companion to Science Fiction.
Paul DeFilippo, I've dabbled in this area in a book called Ribofunk, and that kind of represents my some venturing to date into this little corner of science fiction.
I'm Gwyneth Jones. I've written a trilogy in which I invented some aliens, and I suppose they were biological, and it's possible the trilogy was hard science fiction, but really I should probably be on this panel under my other name, which is Anne Hallam, because Anne Hallam, who writes for teenagers, has just written a book about in vivo genetic engineering, followed by a book about somebody who, a contemporary story about the announcement that there are actually 14-year-old human clones. And it's about stories, the story of one of those girls.
There is, as usual, in any sort of, I'll say taxonomic this time, problem, some difficulty in deciding whether a particular kind of science fiction should be called hard or not. And I'd like, this is a dirty trick, really, I'd like each of my colleagues to suggest very roughly, very broadly, where you think the boundary lies.
I tend to take a really wide-open view on what constitutes biology, because I think without doing that, we're going to ostracize a lot of very potentially interesting material. I'm thinking of artificial life, the whole notion of computer-based software packets that mimic living things, and to me, you know, a good story about artificial life would probably venture into the realms of biological hard SF. And I'm also thinking of some of the more outrageous definitions of what it means to be alive. When you think of people who define life as an entity that reproduces its genetic information, simply that, or reproduces enough information to allow a subsequent generation to appear. And you have scientists who say, well, an auto-assembly line, a very sophisticated auto-assembly line, might be alive in the sense that, you know, cars are being reproduced by this this plant or overall mechanism, and in some sense, you know, they're willing to extend the definition of what life is to something even as seemingly mechanistic as that. So, in to keep it short, what basically I have a very wide open perception of what biological hard SF is, and I probably, with Hal's example, I probably, you know, toss that Mercury story into the mix.
Okay. I've just written 5,000 words on what hard science fiction is, so I'm not going to give you the real detailed version of this. I'll give you the sort of off-the-cuff, slightly amusing version. First of all, the generally used definition of hard science fiction is fiction that adheres to the known scientific facts and generally has the proper attitude. And something that's usually not said but is really part of this package, particularly in terms of attitude, is that it also tends to have techno-libertarian politics. And if we were to give you a story and say to the whole audience and say, read this and tell me if it's hard science fiction, you would be much more likely to toss it out as not being hard science fiction because it has a bad attitude towards science or because it has the wrong politics than because it plays too loosely with the facts. However, that having been said, the definition I work with when working with hard science fiction is I'm really much more interested in whether the author thinks they're writing hard science fiction than whether it looks like other previous examples of hard science fiction. Because after all, we're working with an intersection of science and fiction. Both fiction and science are supposed to change. So making it look exactly like hard science fiction of, say, 1964 is not necessarily a virtue, either in terms of fiction or science. And so I'm most interested in finding authors who think they're doing hard science fiction and seeing what they do. So if the author thought they were writing hard SF, well, I would be interested in seeing it. Right?
That's kind of reverse engineering. You get the product first, and then you work backwards to the
yeah.
specs in a way.
Yeah, I mean, Greg Egan doesn't have the right attitude,
right.
But he's clearly writing hard SF.
Sure, as a crass commercial writer, I would say, if you like hard biological SF, that's what I write. But if you don't like that stuff, I never write that. And I think it's a very, you know, when you talk about the writer's attitude, I think that's part of it. As a hard SF writer who is as far from a libertarian as you can be, I'm a Canadian, I'm semi-socialist and all that kind of stuff, I've always objected to what Catherine has very astutely identified as the political aspect of hard science fiction, which is very much associated with right-wing libertarianism, Jerry Pornell and writers along those lines. But I'm not sure that a work, you know, despite the fact that I love writing about quantum physics, I'm not sure that the nature of a work changes when an observer comments upon it. It either is or is not hard science fiction, regardless of what the author wrote in their occupation line of their tax return. What do? I write hard science fiction. Doesn't suddenly make the story that Hal suggested hard SF. On the other hand, I think my hard SF definition is one that Stan Schmidt uses. This is not biological, it's not in 10 seconds. Is that if the science is integral to the story, so that if you were to remove the scientific element, you're left with no story, it's hard science fiction.
But that's also his definition of SF.
So I adhere to his definition. I think there's a lot of stuff published that are presented as SF, which is not, in fact, science fiction. It's certainly not hard science fiction.
I come to this dishonestly because I'm not a biologist either, nor any other kind of scientist, but I think hard science fiction for me is pretty much what you've said. Use the science, try to use it accurately. If it isn't integral to the plot, it's not very useful. I was sitting here thinking about my own work and trying to figure out what was what. And I have a novel called Wild Seed that I would call science fantasy. And since we're talking about biological things, I think biological science fantasy. I have a character who is a healer, does this reaching out psychically and healing other people, but knows her own body and is able to control it so completely that she is able to extend her knowledge to other people. And is alive early enough so that she knows none of the terminology for internal organs, that sort of thing, nor genetics, which she also manages to know something about. just because of her knowledge of her own body. And still, I feel that that should probably be called science fantasy. On the other hand, in my Xenogenesis books, I'm dealing with aliens who are natural genetic engineers and who are doing things like treating human beings as part of a captive breeding program, and who are using all sorts of methods of breeding to get more of us and improve us, whether we think so or not. And yet, I think it probably works as hard science fiction. I find that I am attracted to biomedical science fiction for some reason. I have no idea why. I created a disease in a story called The Evening and the Morning and the Night that I was told by one of the best compliments I've gotten. I was told by an MD that it worked for her. My agent told me that some people were talking to her about it because they thought it was not science fiction. And I made up a pretty terrible disease there, so and apparently managed to be convincing about it. So I guess that's another aspect, really. How convincing are you with your biology? Whether you've gotten it right or not, how convincing are you with it?
You've also just very quickly touched on something I see a fair bit of as a science fiction writer. Those science fiction writers who are really keeping up to date with what's going on are often presenting stories to readers who remember their high school science education or have learned their science through science fiction and will tell you, well, that's not right, which is what you got from the agent. And the MD, who's right on the cutting edge, will say, you've got it perfectly. There's a problem in that nobody in this room applies to this, but in general, there is a problem amongst this, a lot of the science fiction readership thinking that they know their science really well when what they know is 1980s or 1970s science. And you just don't have time in a novel, let alone a short story, to encapsulate 30 years of advancement in the field for them.
Yeah, my husband David Harwell tells me he had a problem in terms of reviewing Joan Slonczewski's most recent novel because the science she was using was so far beyond what the audience knew that reviewers were complaining about the fantasy elements in the book.
One of my favorite novels of biological SF is Needle, which is virtually devoid of physics. It is a hard SF biological novel.
Yeah, it was written with in a nasty frame of mind in one sense. John Campbell had said that writing a science fiction detective story was impossible. And in an article by L. Sprague de Camp, Design for Life, a two-parter in Astounding a couple of years before that, he had estimated that range for intelligent life, making allowance for how many cells you needed for a brain and how many we would have to put to work to manage a large body, was somewhere between about 40 pounds and the weight of a small grizzly. And I was trying to make a liar out of him, too.
This guy's just vicious.
Science fiction writers are kind of camp followers or groupies of science itself. Science fiction writers tend to follow the fashions that are current in the science world and in the science culture. When I started reading science fiction, oh God, there I am doing it again, anecdotes from my early childhood. When I started reading science fiction, it was all topology and billiard balls and rubber sheets. And I thought it was totally fascinating, and I thought that was science fiction. I had no idea that this was, not until later when I started to read some of the background of this actual science, that this was camp following on the new physics. And I think that in the decades between the pulps and the 1970s, biology wasn't sexy, it wasn't hot, and so it tended, and so it didn't get included in the definition of hard science fiction. If biology had been hot and sexy and people had been making fortunes out of creating new chromosomes, or bits of new chromosomes, or patenting bits of chromosomes that had always been there, then it would have been, biology would have been hard SF from the 1940s, but as time goes by, fashions change. I was very much into biology and especially genetics for the last decade, but now I'm almost forgetting about that because I'm really interested in neuroscience because that's what's happening in popular science.
But isn't that probably biology?
Well, but I'm not interested in the genetics anymore because I'm...
Genetics is so last week.
Your point is that where the boundary line lies is going to change with historical time.
Yeah.
The panel description had an interesting line, which was whether or not we predated this, I don't know if somebody has it right in front of them, predated all of the breakthroughs in genetics as writing about biological SF, or whether we're just sort of following in the wake of what's happened in the last 20 years. And I had lunch with Peter Hollis, who's near the back there, and he actually raised his voice to me in the bar today, probably only to be heard over the other patrons, to vociferously say that we're just following in the wake of what's happening in real science.
No.
But I'm with Paul here, and I want to hear why Paul and I agree, but
well,
I do agree with him.
But, you know, if you turn to, like, the entry in Kluge's encyclopedia for biology as a theme in SF, you'll see that there's always been a thread stretching probably back to the beginnings of SF. You have early stories like Julian Huxley's The Tissue Culture King, and I'm interested in my own biological hard SF in exploring the nature of what it means to be human in a future where all the parameters that we've come to take for granted can be so easily changed. And I kind of have as my beacon a saying by Greg Baer, who said, anybody who imagines that 50 years from now the average human will look like one of us sitting here today is totally blind to what's happening. I really think that that's an angle of SF that, you know, it's so easy to do a future, a space opera set 10,000 years ahead and everybody looks like Captain Kirk, you know, and if there's no, they're just baseline humans. And I think that's probably the one of the major underdeveloped areas of this.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think that's a really provocative thing to say because it does with science what I like to do with it. It forces you to look at the way people are, the politics, the psychology. Yeah, we're going to look pretty much like this in 50 years because anybody who doesn't look pretty much like this, the first few are going to be really so trashed that there aren't going to, you know, be very many following up. We've looked like this for a long time and we're kind of in love with it.
Also, we've been...
Something about biology as hard as that is that with the other sciences that I've grown up with in science fiction, where was the ethical and human... level of interest, level of content. When you talk about changing the nature of being human, then immediately you have ethical and moral questions.
Sure, which are very right material for fiction.
Are those there in what is generally taken to be, I'm trying to be very careful about this, typical hard science fiction?
Well, agreed.
So there's a big historical divide in the biological science fiction. I would divide it into two pieces. The pre-1980s that approaches biology more or less in the mode of its approach to physics. You know, one of the later ones of this, but I think is a perfect illustration, is Ed Bryant's Giants, where you make the ants larger because they'll collapse under their own weight. I mean, it's using a very simple kind of physical principle. Whereas after the sort of post-Blood Music, post Paul Macaulay's Gene Wars, etc., approach biology as biology, or even physics in the terms of biology, as in Greg Egan's Wang's Carpets. So there's the biological thinking dominating biological hard SF after that period, and then there's the physics thinking dominating anything really they're borrowing from biology before that. But the other thing is there's a to return a little bit to politics, because it is relevant even though this is about hard SF, this particular mode of hard SF is a rebellion against a kind of political death of hard SF in the mid-80s, in which hard SF became very tightly bound up with the Reagan administration Star Wars program. And there was, in particular in Britain, but also to some extent in the United States, a rebellion against this kind of right-wing political entanglement. And one of the escape routes was Biological Hard SF, which gets you completely, or at least temporarily, out of the realm of the military.
One of the things that I think is a mistake which crops up, well, it cropped up years ago and before the biological aspect was really hard science fiction, but it was the assumption of human evolution and what our descendants would look like. And at this point, I would say that this is one of the least likely of phenomena, because changing enough to make new species, speciation, depends for one of its essentials on reproductive isolation. And the planet has never been less isolated in all of prehistory that I can think of. Maybe back in Gondwana land or somewhere, but I suspect there were some separating mountain ranges even then. Right now, any new gene that mutates, if it's viable at all, or is likely to produce anything viable at all, is extremely likely to be spread through a wide variety of races, is the most you can say, very, very quickly.
It's the sort of thing more likely to happen if we go to another world and settle there.
Yes. Yes.
Well, okay. We're doing pretty well in this one.
Comments I want to make.
No, I mean for a new species.
Yeah.
On the ethics, ethical issues, I think they are not necessarily absent. I know it's easy to say, they're just an example. But The Cold Equations is clearly an ethical story based entirely on hard physical law.
That's a hot button story.
I understand it's a hot button story. It does not make it a bad example for this issue, though.
Oh.
The great thing about hot button stories, Catherine, is they're worth considering rather than worth dismissing. Secondarily, I would say, in terms of the issue of whether we followed the curve or not, I agree with Brian Aldiss that the first work of real science fiction is Frankenstein, and to me that's clearly a biological SF story, and for its time, hard SF. Victor really is researching the process of decay and corruption that occurs in biological matter after death so that he could reverse it. Certainly, if you go right back to it, biology came before people writing about biology.
See,
that's always going to be true.
In terms, Octavia, you think that 50 years from now we'll still look pretty much the same.
Yep.
I don't see it. I have.
We're not very tolerant.
Well,
and people who have disfigurements of some kind that are visible are going to get much more hell.
Well, let me just give some examples that I think might run counter to that, and that is number one, the willingness of people to inflict not genetic mutations on their body at this point, but somatic mutations, and I'm talking about such things as Gwyneth's nose ring.
Yes.
Yeah.
Gwyneth's nose ring, tattooing.
But we've always been willing to do that.
Okay, but now we've always been willing to do that, so you're saying there's something in the human personality that welcomes such uniquenesses in terms of scarification and tattooing and stuff. What happens when you can implant a little coxcomb on your head as a little cosmetic thing,
But maybe that's cyclic. I mean, it's fashionable to do body modification now.
Yeah.
It's fashionable to, I do believe, have implanted whiskers and maybe an implanted tail, maybe vampire fangs. But it's fashion, and it could be completely different.
Right. There's always a core of early adapters, they call them in the tech field, people who want the latest computer or the latest VCR type device, and they're willing to deal with the bugginess of it until it gets perfected. And I think that core of early adapters that are out there, as more biological processes come on the market, I really believe you're going to see people adapting that. And
although dealing with bugginess when it's likely to be inside your head,
sure, it's dangerous. But you're going to see, so is getting beads implanted under your brow.
Different degree of danger.
Well, you and I have very similar noses. If you look at us in profile, Gwyneth and I have very similar noses, dashingly lovely noses. But yours is distinct from mine. Okay, the point is that a lot of what the kind of stuff that's been going on for thousands of years has been, how will I distinguish my nose, my forehead, my bicep, my breasts from your nose, forehead, bicep, and breast?
Yeah.
When you start talking about putting a coxcomb on your head,
yeah,
I think, freak! Right? But if you just want to have a tattoo or a nose ring or
tattoos
whatever else.
Tattoos were once the height of freakishness, and so were nose rings.
If you're wearing something visible that makes you better than the rest of us,
yeah,
you may have a problem.
Oh, sure. I'm not saying there won't be prejudice and bigotry and ostracism
you
and stuff. But I'm saying that the human urge to experiment with the body, especially if there are benefits to it. What if, okay, now I know that recently it's been disproved that sharks do get cancer, but for a while it was sharks don't get cancer. We need to figure out why this is and incorporate it. What if you were told that the addition of shark genetic material into your body would mean you never got cancer?
Non-visible.
Would it do it?
Non-visible.
It would just mean you're more likely to go to law school.
What if you go to law What if they couldn't quite separate it out, and you got scales on your arms, but you were guaranteed from being without cancer for the rest of your life? Oh well, shark skin. Okay, you wouldn't take that. You wouldn't say, okay, I'll take the shark skin arms if I'm guaranteed never to get cancer for the rest of my life.
You might not reproduce. I mean, you know, your particular kind of adventurousness might end with you,
especially with shark skin.
Much more science fictional path for this kind of for body modification, and that is to do with the problem of space exploration with bodies that can't survive in a hard vacuum, and with bodies with bones that will melt. And if you stay, people who are traveling to Mars have to be on the exercise bike 23 hours a day.
Where the distinction lies between decoration and mutilation is always going to be a variable.
I suspect also that what we're doing, what you're doing and you're saying 50 years from now, is straight line thinking. Whatever we're doing, we'll keep doing it until... And we've done it a lot in science fiction.
Oh, if I were to do not straight line thinking, things would be even more outrageous.
But it will be a matter of something that happens, as opposed to a few people deciding to radically alter themselves and then others catching on.
Yeah, well, part of what we deal with in science fiction is what makes an interesting story. And at this point, I think I've seen enough stories on people having differently shaped bodies by virtue of, you know, fashionable body modification. I'd be much more interested right now in reading a story about the horrible autoimmune problems that would happen when they started injecting all kinds of weird DNA into their bodies.
There are certain worldviews that SF writers and readers are expected to share, and certain ones that are considered not appropriate, despite the fact that they may in fact be valid other worldviews. SF is filled with unexamined political assumptions, one of which is that Western and post-industrial revolution technology and medicine is superior to anything else the human race has ever produced. It's an unchallenged assumption, but it is very much there throughout most of SF, and I agree with you that it's probably wrong that that is the case.
Okay, clearly this could go on for some time if it weren't for the existence of time.
Today on Change Surfer Radio, we've been listening to a panel discussion on biological hard science fiction. The panelists were the science fiction authors Octavia Butler, Hal Clement, Catherine Kramer, Paul DeFilippo, Gwyneth Jones, and Robert Sawyer. They were speaking on July 14, 2002, at the 14th Annual ReaderCon, a conference on literary science fiction held every summer outside of Boston. For more information about the ReaderCon, go to ReaderCon.org. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio. Change Surfer Radio is produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. If you want to learn more about democratic transhumanism, or you want to share your thoughts about today's show with me, Dr. J, email me at jhughes, that's J-H-U-G-H-E-S, at changesurfer.com. At the Change Surfer website, you can find past and future shows archived in streaming MP3, thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project. Also, at www.changesurfer.com are instructions on how to order copies of our shows and myriad relevant links. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.